Good afternoon, everyone. Again, this is the market call for Perkins Coie Trust Company. And we hope this finds you well. I guess I'll start by saying 2020, as all of us know, has been an extraordinary year. I think it was March 11th that the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus a pandemic, and we are over 4 months into that. And still, there is a process to address that. This call and our goal is to provide perspective that the trust company has to what's going on in the markets, in the economy, because we've seen a lot of activity over the last 4 months. Andrew Ellefson is our chief investment officer, and he will be the one presenting. My name's Chris Walcott. I'm Chief Trust Officer. There will be a Q&A session following the call. So Andrew will take about the next 30 minutes, share our perspectives, and open it up for Q&A. If you have questions, we ask that you would email those questions to pctcinvestments@perkinscoie.com. Again, that's pctcinvestments, plural, at perkinscoie.com. This is a podcast format, so if you're joining by computer, you will see the tile that's up there, but there will be no slides to accompany it. We will be recording this call, so following this call, we will send a link to everyone so that you can go back and listen to it if you would like to do so. With that, I will open it up. And Andrew, please take it away.
Thank you so much, Chris, and thank you all for joining us on this beautiful Seattle summer day. This is my 136th day of quarantine, and I'm coming to you live from my basement as usual. And I know time tends to lose all meaning as we're all trapped at home, so we appreciate you spending some of your time with us today. As Chris mentioned, the plan today is to discuss the ongoing pandemic and its economic impacts and of course the market reaction to both of those events. So, but we also wanted to discuss the current earnings season, which can give us some insights into how the rest of the year will shape up and how companies are coping with the current environment. And as Chris mentioned, if you have any questions, please use the email on the screen and we will do our best to answer all of those questions that come in. So let's turn to the economy and actually the pandemic first, and I'm going to combine those two conversations this afternoon because it's increasingly difficult to untangle those two events. It's been an incredibly interesting day today from a data perspective on the economy. We got Q2 GDP numbers this morning, down 32.9%. Which was the worst quarter since the 1940s, and I believe since they began officially recording the data. We also had personal spending data down 34.6% in the second quarter, and a really impressive services spending number down a shocking 43.5%. So really a suffering services economy at this point. We did have non-defense government spending up 39.7%, and that is mostly due to the CARES Act, which was passed earlier this year by Congress. And it really shows the impact and the value of those fiscal stimulus measures. And we will circle back and talk about those a bit more later. In terms of other economic data, we also got initial jobless claims this morning, which had been improving since April. But began to get worse again about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. We currently have about 1.4 million per people per week seeking initial assistance for jobless claims, and about 14.4 million people on continuous claims, so continuing to seek assistance. In terms of economic data, we also had the Fed speak yesterday very extensively about this ongoing crisis. So we've had a lot of new information in the last 24 hours, and so this is a fairly timely call for us. But first, let's step back a little bit and recap some of the year, as that will set the background for us and the current conditions that we're seeing in the data. So if I could have you cast your minds back to March, when we did host our first call, we knew very little about the virus at that point, other than it was here, it was entrenched, and it was spreading very quickly. The epidemiological and economic models at that time factored in the probability of really a wildfire-like spread of the virus across the entire country, essentially uncontrolled and unstoppable, just sweeping across the country. And it was really a moment of maximum fear and maximum uncertainty. And you saw that in the market reaction. The S&P 500 fell about 33% in the course of 23 days, beginning in late February. And, you know, the triage response at that point for the virus was to shut down everything and trade some economic damage for essentially better health outcomes, believing that an uncontrolled virus was going to ultimately do more economic damage as well as cost mass suffering. So, you know, it was a trade-off made fairly deliberately, but with very little information at the time. So as we moved through March and April, we really did gain a better understanding of a few things, one of which is the transmission mechanisms of this virus. We also were able to witness a handful of countries that really did have success limiting the spread and through testing, tracing, and isolating populations. We learned the value of social distancing and masks and essentially proved that those can be effective methods of limiting transmissions. And so, you know, with that new information in hand, as we entered May and June, the models, both epidemiological and economic, began to evolve from that wildfire-like spread to more of a hotspot model, with local governments increasing and decreasing measures to control the spread based on the local prevalence of the virus. And local economies are also opening and closing relative to those local outbreaks. So, you know, with that increased knowledge and these new models in place, the virus and economy essentially reduced the market's fear from that maximum fear we experienced in March to a significantly reduced amount of market fear and market uncertainty through April. And that's really what led to that market rally we had in the back half of March. We're now up just shy of 45% since March 23rd in the S&P 500. That said, we are still a long way from normal, but we can look at some non-traditional data sets to get a sense of how open or closed various local economies are at the moment. And so if you look at things like the open table reservations on the app, restaurants are still experiencing about 65% less business than they were at the beginning of the year. We can look at TSA throughput at airports. TSA throughput is still down about 80% this year. So some economists are now describing essentially what's looking like two separate recessions for 2020. We have the Great Lockdown, which emerged in late February and early March, and essentially was that maximum fear response. And in that sense, the worst is behind us in terms of negative GDP, which was this quarter, this morning's data. In terms of job losses, when we hit well over $20 million people out of work, in terms of economic damage and in terms of wealth destruction. But we still have what is going to look much more like a traditional recession in front of us, including continued high unemployment, potential bankruptcies, potentially lower GDP. But in some senses, it will also not be traditional. We have an immense amount of pent-up demand in consumption. And we have exceedingly high savings rates right now across a number of income earning quartiles. So there is more recession in front of us, but the worst is behind us. And we'll evaluate some of those inputs here. So at this point, what we have is essentially a Gordian knot or a problem that cannot easily be untied. The prevalence of the virus is tied to the economic reopening, and the economic reopening is tied to the prevalence of the virus. And in the fable of the Gordian knot, it's said to have been resolved by when Alexander the Great cut the knot with his sword. And so in this case, the sword that would potentially cut this Gordian knot is a potential vaccine. So we've had some interesting data on vaccines over the last 2 weeks. About a week and a half ago, there was a House committee hearing regarding vaccines with reports from the CEOs of the five major frontrunners for a vaccine on their anticipated timelines for administration of those first doses of that vaccine. And just to give you some context, the average vaccine takes about 10.7 years to develop and bring to market, and only 6% of those ever make it to market. So it's an exceedingly low occurrence of vaccine success. But that said, you know, the Ebola vaccine was rushed through the process in just 10 months. So there's sort of a wide spectrum of outcomes in terms of vaccines. It's a very tough business, the vaccine economic model, with fairly mediocre returns. And so, as always, the solution is to throw money at the problem. And we have done that. So we have in place what's called Operation Warp Speed, which has established the goal of delivering 300 million doses of the vaccine by the end of the year. And in my personal opinion, that looks a little bit ambitious. But it does appear as if we will have the potential to deliver up to 100 million doses by the end of the year. So let me recount where we stand now with those five frontrunners very quickly. So we have AstraZeneca, and they suggested in the committee hearing that they will have emergency doses available by the end of the year, which is great news. They're working with, I believe, Oxford University. We have Moderna, which has submitted data to the FDA. We'll submit data to the FDA by the end of the year. And they just began recruiting for a 30,000 person trial this week. So that's progressing nicely. We have Pfizer, which is a name in our portfolios. They were awarded a $1.5 billion manufacturing contract by the U.S. government, I believe last week, to begin producing their own potential vaccine, which is in late stage development as well. And the management of Pfizer believes they will have 100 million doses able to be delivered by the end of this year, with a potential 1.3 billion doses able to be delivered globally by the end of 2021. So really, in terms of manufacturing capacity, it looks like Pfizer is probably in the lead at this point, if their virus is successful. And excuse me, their vaccine is successful. And then we had Johnson & Johnson, which hopes to have data in early 2021. And we had Merck, who is planning for 2021 at the earliest. So five potential vaccine candidates. It looks like three are front runners with one clear manufacturing front runner. It's also worth mentioning at this point that a vaccine is not necessarily an immediate solution to our economic woes. Beyond just the logistical and distribution issues, there was recent polling data that indicated only 42% of Americans intend to get the vaccine, with 25% outright refusing and 33% unsure whether they would take it. So it will help get our economy back going, but it is not a quick or immediate turnaround of circumstances. So for now, it does appear as if we're limited in our economic recovery until a healthcare resolution can find a solution for the virus. And in that context, we are going to need additional monetary and fiscal stimulus. And it will be more important than ever to prevent temporary economic damage from becoming permanent economic damage. And I think we saw that very clearly in the GDP data this morning. So where we stand currently on future fiscal stimulus, a few months ago, about 3 months ago, the House passed a $3.5 trillion stimulus package. Just on Monday this week, the Senate has proposed their own $1 trillion stimulus package. And so obviously there's some negotiating to do to narrow the gap between $1 and $3.5 trillion. But we as an investment team do strongly believe that there will be a resolution fairly rapidly here, as the damage from the expiration of a number of support programs begins to show up in the data. We have the end of the PPP program at the end of this year. We have the federal unemployment benefits that are expiring at the end of this week. And the eviction moratorium will begin to expire here shortly. So we do anticipate quite a bit of news on that front from Congress in the next week or two. I briefly mentioned earlier that the Fed has also spoken recently. They were kind enough to provide quite a bit of guidance to the markets yesterday. Chairman Powell was speaking. And as a reminder, the Fed really has two mandates. They are tasked with maintaining full employment of the economy and with stable prices. And generally, stable prices are viewed as 2% inflation. Chairman Powell, in terms of the first mandate, the full employment mandate, was very clear that he intends to keep interest rates near zero for a very long time to help return the economy to full employment. He explicitly has stated in the past that he expects 2022 to be the earliest he would consider rate rises. And in fact, in yesterday's testimony, he said he's not even thinking about raising rates at this point. He also pledged to maintain extensive support for the economy yesterday, extending all the tools that they created and launched in March and April. And so he also emphasized that you know, the Fed's role here is through lending power, not spending power, and that really Congress needs to step up and pass additional measures to combat bankruptcies and unemployment. You know, whereas the Fed was very critical in March and April when markets lacked confidence, it is now much more of a supporting player in the ongoing recovery. They have essentially done as much as they can at this point. They are doing their best to keep the economic disruption from cascading through credit channels, which is key, but they can't resolve unemployment alone at this point. The second major focus of the Fed is, as I said, stable prices, and this has become fairly topical in the last week or two. You're seeing the market begin to have concerns about inflation, and you're seeing that in the price of gold, silver, and Bitcoin, and you're also seeing the value of the U.S. dollar slip relative to other. The Fed, as I said, indicated they don't see any signs of inflation on the horizon. And at a very basic level, inflation is essentially too much money chasing not enough goods. That is not a problem we have at the moment. I think Chairman Powell and I share the view that there are more deflationary pressures at this time than inflationary pressures. So first and foremost, we obviously had the demand shock from the virus, where you know, consumer spending fell through the floor. And so the increased money that is being injected into the system at this point essentially has nothing to be spent on. The top two quartiles of income earners has seen spending fall by 9.9% this year, and in fact has seen their savings rate skyrocket in the first two quarters of this year, essentially because they're not taking vacations, they're not buying new cars, they're not going out to restaurants, whatever it is, but they are seeing their bank accounts swell. Meanwhile, the bottom two quartiles of income earners, spending has fallen by only 2.3% this year. They are essentially spending every dollar that comes in the door, including the recent stimulus checks and increased unemployment benefits. And so really, you know, when you're talking about fiscal stimulus, it's almost a one-for-one that goes back into the economy for those bottom two quartiles of income earners. In terms of you know, a mid to long term inflation picture, you know, sustained domestic inflation is really very highly correlated to sustained higher wage growth. So it's really hard to see how anything other than a transitory inflation could crop up in the short to midterm, given the picture around current unemployment and the high levels of people seeking work at this point. You are unlikely to see wage pressure upwards. The other source of concern about inflation is obviously the Fed balance sheet has swelled in response to the pandemic from $3.7 trillion to about $6.4 trillion this year. That money has been injected into markets to prop up the credit markets, to provide liquidity, and to provide the good functioning of money market funds and bond funds and all sorts of investment products. If you look back at the post-2008 experience, in a very similar environment where the Fed's balance sheet swelled very quickly, much of that liquidity never really sparked consumer price inflation. It managed to keep it from going full deflation, but instead a lot of that liquidity ended up in assets as companies essentially borrowed at exceedingly low interest rates and used that money to buy back stock. And so I would expect, it's my personal opinion, that you will see a lot of that money sort of end up in asset prices. And that may be part of what has driven this extreme rally we've seen in quarter. So at that point, let's turn our attention to the markets. The rally that we talked about that began on March 23rd has resulted in the S&P 500 rising by nearly 45% at this point. We are essentially now flat on the year. The S&P is just above 0% this year. But that rally has really come from sort of two camps. It's really been a disparate outcome depending on which companies you're talking about. So the top five stocks in the S&P 500, which include Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google, have essentially made up a disproportionate amount of that return. They have averaged on a weighted basis a 32% year-to-date return, where the other 495 stocks have returned a weighted average negative 7.7% year-to-date. So really just two wildly different stories, depending on if you're a large tech company or somebody else in the S&P 500. The big five that we just talked about now account for over 22% of the S&P 500's market cap. That is well in excess of the long-term average since 1927 of about 17% for the five largest companies. And it's just near an all-time high for concentration of the index. And really remarkably, I think, you know, that those top five companies now have a combined market cap that is greater than the GDP of the 27 countries that compose the EU. I used to be a growth stock mutual fund manager and in fact wasn't investing in Europe at the time. And as a growth stock manager, we always performed best during periods when growth was scarce. So essentially during periods of recession, when it's hard to find companies that are growing, those that are growing do the best. What has always happened historically is that when growth broadens out, the market performance also broadens out from those growth companies to all the companies, including value and those with lower growth rates. So clients have been asking me, you know, does it make sense to continue to invest in any of these big five companies? And I would say, yes, but you need to be very selective about that. We saw yesterday an additional challenge for many of these large tech companies crop up as there were some very heated congressional hearings yesterday. We had the CEOs of four of those companies testifying to Congress. And, you know, we really witnessed increasing support on both sides of the aisle to evaluate the concentrated power that Amazon, Facebook, and Google have amassed at this point. And I would expect that there will be some legislation proposed, and whether it's passed is a different story entirely, but I do suspect you will see legislation proposed to limit the powers of some of these companies. We continue to believe that Microsoft and Apple are very well positioned within the big tech names to continue their exceptional growth trajectories. All, you know, while returning value to shareholders over the long term. And we also tend to believe they're a little bit less exposed to regulatory pressures at this point, particularly as they have quite a bit of competition in a few of their business lines. But that said, they are not exempt from any legislation that may come down the pipeline. Before wrapping up, I did also want to discuss the current earnings season with you. Companies, you know, generally report four times per year. Their quarterly earnings, and many of those companies will host conference calls to share insights on the prospects of their companies. And so our team has been reading the transcripts and listening to the calls for the past few weeks, and we've gathered some common themes and just some observations from those conference calls. 53% of the S&P 500 have reported their earnings now, and in that 53%, we have seen that on average, the earnings reported have surprised Wall Street by 16.8%. Sales on average have surprised Wall Street by over 2%. And those numbers may seem a little bit surprising of an outcome given the current environment, but you'll remember my earlier comments about March being a time of extreme fear. And I would expect that many of those estimates were built during that period of extreme fear and never frankly updated to reflect the current economic reopenings. So it was a bit of a low bar, but that said, earnings beats do tend to lead to higher markets over time. So it was generally a positive outcome so far. Looking forward, the average Wall Street expectation at this point for the S&P 500 is to see earnings fall by about 17% over the next 12 months. And to be fair, that also includes that sort of pessimistic view from earlier March. So we may see that creep up over time as companies have beat their earnings. Interestingly, the average expectation for the small cap universe is to see earnings fall by nearly 45%. So a very large difference in outcomes for large companies and small companies at this point. This is partially driven because those five big tech companies we talked about obviously have earnings growth still. But it's also driven by the small cap index has quite a few energy firms and some of the folks who have been hardest hit by this pandemic. So we will keep an eye on that. Generally in these calls, companies have been very hesitant to provide any forward quantitative guidance. They don't want to put a number or a line in the sand and be held to account to it. But they're providing quite a bit of qualitative guidance. So talking about the environment and how they're performing within it. So many expect that we're actually past the worst of the economic damage, which our team believes as well. They do see generally a brighter 2021, and in fact, most companies are talking about a normalized environment by 2022. Other points of interest in the calls we've observed, we've seen quite a rapid resumption of industrial production, spurred by that lower US dollar we talked about, as well as by global demand for manufacturing components. China really has resumed their economy quite quickly and resumed buying from the US. Tech growth does continue, absolutely, but it is not entirely unaffected by the pandemic. We've seen that in a number of earnings that were slightly lower than anticipated in the tech part of the index. One of the really obvious conclusions, I suppose, from earnings regarding the pandemic, people are shopping from home. There was a full 6-point jump in the percent of shopping done online. So at the beginning of the year, only 13% of all shopping was done online. Currently, 19% of all shopping is done online. And we had earnings from UPS, United Parcel Service, this morning, confirming that trend, saying package deliveries have increased by 22.8% last quarter, with residential deliveries up 65%. So really a phenomenal amount of online activity currently. Many companies are anticipating that pent-up demand we talked about earlier. So we had Starbucks and some other companies discussing that when they reopened, they were quite surprised by by both the quantity and the size of the orders. So more people coming through and ordering more things at once than anticipated. And lastly, many of the companies that we're talking to and hearing from are reevaluating their cost structures. Both given the challenges of pandemic, but also given the work from home atmosphere that's sort of been forced upon all of us at this point. So historically, companies tend to exit recessions with ultimately higher profit margins from being leaner companies from living through those tough periods. So it's been an interesting earnings season. I think it's been really insightful. Generally, I think people have been a little bit more optimistic than they would have been 2 or 3 months ago. There's still challenges ahead, obviously, but it does appear as if many of those challenges are at least being dealt with at this point. So with that, I want to thank you all for listening. We've thrown a lot of information out there, and as always, I want to offer that our team is available for any follow-ups you may have. And Chris, maybe we can open up for questions if any have come in.
Sure. And as a reminder for everyone on the call, if you do have any questions and you want to submit them for Andrew to try and get to here during our call, please email those to PCTCinvestments@perkinscoie.com. Again, PCTCinvestments, plural, @perkinscoie.com. Looks like we've got a couple to begin with. First one, if the market takes another leg down, do you think that it's another March-like experience?
That's a great question, and it's a question that I'm getting from quite a few people. I think the scars of March are still fresh, if you will. I would not expect another environment like March due to this pandemic, mostly because we are past that maximum fear point, and we do have so much more data about how the virus transmits and how the economic response shapes up. It's really hard to emphasize the degree of fear that was in the market in March. It far exceeded the worst of the 2008 crisis, in my opinion. I remember the day that Lehman Brothers collapsed and the market thought it was the end of the world. And frankly, there were days in March that felt worse than that. So I don't believe we will see another environment like that due to this pandemic. But that said, I do not have perfect foresight. So anything is possible, but I think it's an exceedingly low probability at this point.
Earlier, you had mentioned the Fed and Powell just indicating that the potential of raising rates wasn't even on his in his mindset. But question is, when do we perceive that the Fed will begin raising rates?
Yeah, that's a tough question because it's dependent on so many variables. But the things we do know at this point are that, as we came into 2020 and the economy was looking good in January, we had about 3.7% unemployment with virtually no inflation at that point. And again, given the Fed's dual mandate of full employment and stable prices, they are unlikely to raise rates until they see that inkling of inflation. And so, we're at about 14.5% unemployment currently. Obviously, a lot of that will come back fairly quickly as people are able to go back to work. But I think, the question then is when do we return to those exceedingly low levels of unemployment? And I think that's probably a few years out still. It's really going to be dependent on the data, both the jobs data and the inflation data. But at this point, those two are very closely tied, and it does appear as if we can have a very low level of unemployment without seeing. So, lower for longer, I think, is the short answer. Anybody who needs to refinance their house, mortgage rates really have bottomed out right around 3% right now on 30-year mortgages. It's unlikely to go lower than that, just because of the structural profitability of banks. So, it's a good environment for that. But I would not plan on higher rates anytime soon.
We've well, time will tell, but we've kind of seen a market recovery. What's our perspective on kind of what the economic recovery looks like moving forward?
I touched briefly on the idea that there's sort of two recessions. So the great closure that the March April experience very much does look like a V-shaped recovery, which is a sharp decline followed by a sharp recovery. I think the second leg of this recovery is going to look a lot more like the 2008 post-recession recovery, which is very low, slow, and long. But sustained. There's a couple, and I say that, and there's a few things that may make me extremely wrong on that front. And that pent-up demand is one of those things. The savings rate of those top two quartiles of income earners, those folks are ready to spend money. They're ready to buy new cars. They are clearly out buying new houses right now using those low rates. So you could see a sharper snapback than I'm anticipating. But I think it's easier to model going forward what you've recently experienced, right? And so in my mind, it's going to be low and slow, but steady, march back towards the sort of a normal level.
This question actually piggybacks on what you were talking about regarding kind of the main five companies making up the S&P. And the question is, kind of with your Apples and Microsofts, Amazons, Googles, how much longer can that disparate performance go on?
Sure. If I knew, I'd be really wealthy. I think there's a couple things that are going on here. First and foremost, technology is clearly a very important and very fast-growing portion of our economy. We are really, moving from an industrial economy to a service economy to an information economy at this point. And so those companies are well positioned for where future growth lies. And then there's some market structure tailwinds that are sort of giving them a very long path for increased market prices. And that's really driven by a couple things. You know, we had the creation of ETF structures in the market and a shift away from active managers who are making stock decisions to passive index investing, which essentially says, I just want to own the market and however the market does is how I'll do. And I believe it's nearly 80% of all funds that flow into the market at this point go into some sort of passive structure. And those passive structures, for the most part, buy the largest companies in the index. And so, you know, for every dollar invested in the S&P 500 passive market, you know, 22% and 22 cents of that dollar are going to these five companies. So it provides sort of a tailwind for prices to just keep rising as long as money continues to flow into the markets. You know, so they have good business models. They have good market structure supporting their prices. And then the headwinds, of course, are the regulatory and the headwinds we talked about. And then there's valuation concerns. Can you justify paying the price you're paying for these companies? And that really gets fairly academic fairly quickly. But in a low rate environment where interest rates are essentially 0%, that interest rate is used to essentially discount future cash flows from these companies back to today's value. And mathematically, it creates this unlimited value scenario where companies could be worth anything, any price you want to put on them academically. Obviously, no investor is going to pay any price on earth for those five companies, but it certainly gives you a longer runway in terms of increasing your share price. I would say, you know, I think I said earlier, you need to be selective about it. You very much want to own this part of the economy. It's growing, it's exciting, it's innovative, it's where a lot of world is heading. But, you know, again, just be selective, be eyes wide open about the valuation you're paying for that, and be eyes wide open about the potential regulatory concern. And that's probably not a great answer for the person asking this question, but to be honest with you, I don't think anybody has a great answer for you.
The last question that we have so far is around real estate, and it's more kind of a bent towards residential real estate. And with the demand staying strong in spite of kind of the weak demand, with the real estate market staying strong, with kind of shortened supply in the housing, and kind of apart from and outside of 2008, which obviously the housing market was impacted heavily. Real estate's stayed generally is really held up well during economic crisis. Do we expect this same trend to continue through the pandemic?
I would say unequivocally yes. And I could say that pretty readily because we had data just this week about pending home sales year on year, and I'm going to forget my decimal points here, but they were up over 12%. I don't remember the exact number. But essentially, existing home sales were very strong, and that's a year-on-year number. So that's comparing to the 2019 data this time of year. People are using these extremely low interest rates to upgrade their houses, to buy bigger houses, to move into their dream house, whatever it is. And you know, we talked earlier about those folks in the two top quartiles for income. You know, they've got more money than they've ever had right now, given the savings rates that they've achieved. And so they have that money for that down payment, and they have these low interest rates to buy these houses. And so you're really seeing that housing transaction market pick up really rapidly as people are able to tour houses and go and begin these purchases again. More than that, you're seeing things like building permits are still very strong year on year. So new houses being constructed are still strong as well. And so those who are able to afford a house and buy a house are viewing it as a very important part of their existence right now, as we are all trapped in our houses. So yeah, I do absolutely expect the housing market to remain strong for the foreseeable future, unless the economic headwinds spread to those two top income quartiles, which so far has been fairly limited.
Well, doesn't look like we have any further questions. Andrew, I appreciate you taking the time to share with all of us. Those on the call, we, like I shared at the onset, we will we're recording this. We will be sending out a link so that if you want, you can listen to this again. We appreciate you. Perkins Coie Trust Company is here to serve. And if there's anything we can be doing, any other questions that you have following the call, please reach out to us. We're here to answer those questions for you. So with that, I guess we will end the call and just thank you for your time.
Thanks, everyone.